Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Well, welcome, everybody. We're coming to you live from the Toby Family Auditorium at the Commonwealth Club. It's Week to Week, the political roundtable for Thursday, February 28th, 2019. I'm John Zipper, your host for Week to Week. Welcome to our seventh anniversary program. We have been through, We've covered two presidential campaigns, Charlottesville, the Tea Party, death of Mayor Ed Lee, and way too much Donald Trump, as I'm sure most people would probably tell us. On tonight's program, we're going to discuss Michael Cohen on Capitol Hill, of course, the Green New Deal, California's GOP leadership, and more. And, of course, we'll send you off with our live news quiz. Everyone's welcome at the Commonwealth Club, so any opinions expressed up here are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. Now let's meet our panelists for tonight. Start right next to me with Dan Borenstein. He's the editorial page editor for the East Bay Times, and you can follow him on Twitter at BorensteinDan. So welcome back, Dan.
Thank you.
Next to, I should say, Dan number one is Carla Marinucci. She's a senior writer for Politico California Playbook, and she's on Twitter at C. Marinucci. So thank you, Carla. And our second Dan is Dan Schnurr, professor at the University of Southern California Annenberg School of Communications. He's on Twitter at Dan Schnurr. So welcome back, Dan. I think you all know how we do this. There are question cards spread throughout the seats. Write out some questions. People will deliver them to me, and I'll try to ask them during our program here tonight. Now let's get on to our roundtable. Michael Cohen spent much of yesterday giving public testimony to the House Oversight Committee. I guess this followed closed-door testimony he had given to congressional committees. Now during this public testimony, President Trump's former lawyer and admitted fixer, well, he admitted previous lying to the Congress, and he accused Trump of numerous acts that could complicate the president's legal fights. Now, congressional Republicans and other supporters of the president responded quite forcefully to Cohen and have been arguing against anyone believing anything he said, right? This is a man who is going to jail for lying. Carla, let's start with you. What are some of the things we learned from Cohen's testimony, or did we not learn anything from
it? Oh, I think we learned a lot. I mean, this was bingeable TV in every way. I don't know about you all, but, you know, this had a little bit of The Sopranos, House of Cards. It had, you know, Goodfellas. It had it all in there. But it had serious stuff that we learned. And I think, you know, not since the 70s, a lot of you remember, I certainly do, watching John Dean, you know, talk about a cancer on the presidency. You had the president's longtime lawyer talking about him being a racist, a liar, a con man. This was shocking stuff. But he had the goods with him. He had the checks that were paid with regard to the National Enquirer stories on Stormy Daniels. He had testimony that Trump knew about that he was possibly going to lie to Congress with regard to the Trump Tower deal in Moscow. He talked about how Trump was aware of the WikiLeaks dumps on Hillary Clinton's emails from Roger Stone. And there were all kinds of, those were sort of the major headlines out of it. But boy, I mean, you had a lot of Californians up there on the oversight panel, and we got some really interesting, tantalizing threads there with regard. You had Ro Khanna asking Cohen about possible criminal conspiracies with regard to Trump, his sons, and whether the Southern District of New York is looking into that. And Cohen didn't want to say, which means yes, they are probably. you had Jackie Speier asking him about whether there were a love child, and what other National Enquirer stories.
And she was clearly disappointed by the answer.
Uh-huh. Right. You know, you had Harley Ruda, who just took the seat from Dana Rohrabacher, getting into the whole Felix Sater, the mobster, the Russian mobster who had the office in the 26th floor of Trump Tower next to the president's office and didn't pay any rent, by the way. I mean, and now he's going to be called. I thought it was fascinating all around, and I think we have just gotten to see the beginnings of some of these other folks being called
for
the committee.
Here's the thing, Carla, and here's the question I really have for you. And for you, Dan, especially as the political expert down, you know, political consultant expert, if you will, have we just watched 2.5 years of political inoculation? In other words, are we at the point where, we knew about most of this stuff already? Was there anything aside from the speakerphone with Roger Stone on the other end? Did we learn anything new that's truly going to move the dial? I'm not convinced, and there are two parts. Is it going to move the dial in public opinion? And, this is a great soap opera, and I agree. It was compelling television, if you will, as compelling as anything in Washington can be. But I'm not sure that we really moved the public opinion dial very much, number one, because people are already so polarized. But the other part of it is, are we really making a difference in terms of anything legally here? I'm not sure we are.
I think we're going to see other Felix Satter is one of the ones going to be called before the Oversight Committee, as are apparently Trump Jr., possibly Ivanka Trump. We're going to hear more about the taxes. There were questions about tax fraud that were very, very relevant. I think this may, have an effect of sort of unraveling what this story is. How much longer the Republicans, though, can just ignore what's going on? And what was, I think, striking about this whole scene yesterday was none of the Republicans on the committee asked any substantive questions about what Cohen was actually saying. They were on the attack on him, but they didn't defend the president.
Well, Congressman Jamie Raskin, the Democrat, I thought analyzed the Republicans' approach to the hearings yesterday perfectly. He said, "You're not angry that the president of the United States is lying. You're not mad that Michael Cohen is lying. You're mad that he's stopped lying." I'd offer a couple thoughts if I can. I think Dan Bornstein, not surprisingly, is onto something here, which is a lot of sizzle, but the steak is still in Robert Mueller's kitchen, and I know we'll talk about that in just a moment. That said, it's not a good week for President of the United States when the failure of a seminal nuclear arms agreement on a world stage is only the second worst thing that happens to you. so not a good week for him, but I think Dan's point is a good one. As Carla said, the president's attorney, former attorney, referred to the president of the United States as a racist, as a liar, and as a criminal. If you thought on Monday of last week that the president of the United States was a racist, a liar, and a criminal, you still do. If you didn't think that on Monday of last week, you still don't. And what's happened, I think, over 2.5 years is an already hyper-polarized and extraordinarily balkanized electorate has become even more polarized and balkanized. We talk a lot about, in my classes, both at SC and at UC Berkeley, about selective outrage. And watching both sides, the Republicans yesterday, but Democrats certainly have their moments on this also, being filled with righteous indignation and outrage when someone on the other side does something wrong, and finding a way to either minimize or ignore it when someone on their side does as well. It was an important week in terms of the shaping of public opinion. But ultimately, as I mentioned earlier, this is all prelude to the release of the Mueller report and what happens then. And we can come back to it later, but I'll offer just one other thought. The most important thing that happened this week from a political perspective was neither North Korea nor Michael Cohen. Rather, it was the vote of the U.S. House of Representatives to push back against the president's declaration of an emergency, of a national emergency on the border. It only requires four members, Republican members of the United States Senate, to pass that bill in the Senate. There are already three. But getting back to the point of Mueller, if the president at some point is impeached, which he probably will be, then it moves to the Senate, at which point the Senate would require a two-thirds vote in order to remove him from office. Mm-hmm. That requires 20 Republican votes. So what we learned this week is that Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski and Tom Tillis are the first three. The question in the months ahead is, at some point, are there 17 other Republicans in the United States Senate who would vote to convict a president of the United States?
And you're thinking of the answer to that is?
I'm thinking it's getting closer. I would say,
really?
I mean, we can rank them if you want. Lamar Alexander, number 4, Mitt Romney, number 5. Yeah. I would tell you, if we don't have time to go through all 20 tonight,
right.
But if you go through it one by one, what you get to is the 19th and 20th Republicans are two of the three Republicans, senators who ran against Donald Trump for president. Lindsey Graham, Ted Cruz, or Marco Rubio, two of those three would need to vote to convict Donald Trump in order for him to be removed from office. So big week, important week, exciting week.
Yeah.
But don't lose sight of the fact that Mr. Mueller is still working very, very quietly. And ultimately what he produces is going to have much more of an impact going forward than anything we saw in Washington over the last several days.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dan Schneider, you bring up Robert Mueller. And I read yesterday that Robert Mueller's people were watching the Michael Cohen testimony very clearly because, of course, Michael Cohen is under a cooperation agreement with the Mueller investigation. And if he had lied at all in the testimony, he could be looking at much more than his current sentence of 3 years in prison. How confident should we be that what Cohen told us yesterday or told Congress yesterday was true?
There's one glaring problem or potential problem in Cohen's testimony, and I'm guessing that anyone who take time out of their lives to attend a discussion like this one has already read this. But when Cohen said yesterday that he had not sought a job in the White House, there's been a significant amount of journalism that suggests just the opposite. And it's been reported, I don't think under Mueller, I think by the Southern District in New York, that in fact there is email traffic that reflects Cohen talking about wanting a White House job. If he lied to Congress yesterday about that, that doesn't mean that everything else he said isn't true. But it makes it a much more complicated case going forward. The other thing to watch in addition to Mueller is watch Nancy Pelosi and Jerry Nadler and Adam Schiff.
Yeah.
Because as more and more and more House Democrats are clamoring for impeachment, I think they have the good sense to, if not stop impeachment proceedings, at least delay them, thinking, I think, correctly, that the faster that the House were to rush to an impeachment, the harder a case they'd have to make to the American people. The more careful, the more cautious, the more measured they are, the more
Dan, how do you see this playing out timing-wise? You know, I'm trying to envision how this would play out timing-wise over the next 2 years.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if this was to happen, because I'm remain unconvinced that impeachment is a winner for the Democrats for 2020. I think it may motivate their base, but I find it hard to believe they really would get the votes in the Senate, push come to shove.
Yeah, I do.
Unless there's a much bigger smoking gun, or unless the report really turns out to be a lot more damning than what we've already heard.
Well, this is where I think Nancy Pelosi and Jerry Nadler and Adam Schiff are approaching this in a very savvy way. They know that their base, on the off chance that there's anyone who represents that base here tonight, feel free to agree, are very, very, very enthusiastic about impeachment. But to your point, Dan, and I think it's the right one, if impeachment is going to be a net positive during a presidential election season as opposed to a net negative, the more measured, the more careful, the more cautious they looked before taking that step, the better off. The better off.
They're going to need a lot more evidence, though. They're going to need a bigger smoking gun than certainly has come out so far.
And I think we're going to see what happens with Mueller. What I'm wondering is whether this is going to be kind of a death by a thousand paper cuts kind of thing, where every day there's more and more headlines unfolding, other issues that damage the president that way. That erode some of the confidence the base has, especially if, say, the economy isn't going as gangbusters.
Oh, yeah, the economy. Yeah. I mean, I think Dan's point is a really good one, and I've heard Carla make it also. the Democrats didn't win back the House of Representatives in November by talking about impeachment.
Yeah.
They won the House back by talking about the economy and by talking about health care and by talking about matters of public policy.
Especially about talking about health care and taxes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So impeachment can shape the landscape, but I think your instinct is exactly right, Dan. It's not the deciding factor in an election. That said, the neat thing about jobs like ours is we get to pretend we have some idea what we're talking about. if anybody can point to a previous instance where a president of the United States was impeached in the middle of his own reelection campaign, we can use that as a precedent. Otherwise, we're just making this up as we go along.
Yeah, yeah. And I think this is where the Democrats now in the 2020 field really have to play it carefully. They have to be talking about the economy. They have to be talking about the issues that matter to voters. They cannot be focusing everything on Trump. And that is the danger as they're out there.
But that doesn't mean not to pursue impeachment. It means not to pursue it in as hysterical a way as some might inclined.
As topic A.
Well, the danger, though, is that you really get, if you will, off message. Impeachment could really throw them off message in a certain sense. If it really becomes a question about if you really want to push the economy, if you really want to push health care, if you want to really push global warming and environmental change, if the whole thing is impeachment, you know, the other danger is if they succeed. I mean, there's this other thing. Then they've lost their foil for 2020. I mean, what if they actually impeached him? You know, I mean, you know what I'm saying? In other words,
remember, in impeachment is not a removal from office; it's the first step.
Right. No.
If he were convicted and removed from office, it would require at least and probably significantly more than 20 Republican United States senators, at which point it became a bipartisan effort.
My point is, if they do actually remove him from office, if the Senate actually does convict him, if you will, then where does that leave you for 2020? You know,
not going to happen.
I would say this: if I were a campaign strategist for any one of the 94 Democrats seeking the presidential nomination,
95 today,
I would not figure that into my calculations. What I would be concerned about is whether those voters in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan who voted for Trump 2.5 years ago, who elected Democratic governors last year, how they're responding to a Green New Deal. And once again, Nancy Pelosi being very, very smart.
Yes, that's right.
Trying to keep a lid on the most aggressive ideological goals within her own caucus, recognizing that it might be a little bit too ambitious for the swing voters that her party's nominee needs to win.
Yeah, and we'll get into the Green New Deal in a little bit. Someone from the audience asks, right along these lines, what do you think about Barney Frank's suggestion that Trump should not be impeached because Mike Pence would be far more electable?
Which is kind of where I was going.
Well, I think your other point, Dan, is the right one here, which is one of timing.
Yeah.
From the day of the Watergate break-in till the day Richard Nixon resigned from office was almost 2 years. From the date that the Monica Lewinsky scandal was first reported till the day that Bill Clinton was acquitted by the Senate was over a year. Don't get me wrong. If a president ought to be removed from office for violating the oath of his office, then he ought to be removed for constitutional grounds. From all practical standpoints, we're talking about months, if not weeks, of difference between when that process would conclude versus when a presidential election would take place.
And the danger of that, I think, is at that point, then people, I think there's a real danger of alienating voters by saying, why are we going through all this when we can just?
That is the Democrats' dilemma here. I think. I agree with you. I think there's a big dilemma for the Democrats.
I think that's the dilemma.
Okay. We've got a number of questions from the audience that are all along the same lines of what will it take to unravel Trump's base? No tax refunds for 2018, or what will it take for the Senate and House Republicans to turn on the president? And when will we get to see the Mueller report?
On the unraveling of the base, I think the tax issue is a big issue. And I'm hearing from a lot of voters out there who were used to getting, say, I just talked to a woman the other day, used to getting, you know, $6,000 back every year. This year it's $400. She's wondering where is it gone? The GOP tax bill here in
California.
They're
not familiar with what they did with adjusting withholding tables.
With the state and local, the state and local deductions for it really hit California. It's hard. And now people are starting to realize the big bite that this is taking. And that is something that's going to hurt him. The issue of health care is going to continue to hurt him. We're hearing more and more stories of people who, you know, cannot, with the efforts to destroy Obamacare came some real consequences on human lives out there. These were the same issues that drove the 2008 election, the issue of health care and those stories of people out there who were dying of cancer and could not afford. We just saw a bunch of headlines about people can't afford insulin. They're having to go to Mexico to get it. These kinds of stories, if they continue, if this kind of reporting continues, I think those are the kind of things that are going to drive voters in the heartland. And issues of jobs. When we're talking about promised auto manufacturing jobs that have not materialized, that promises were made with regard to numbers of jobs in the Rust Belt states that have not materialized. This is stuff that's
I think that's far more important. Yeah. I think, in a certain sense, we can talk, the impeachment in California is a good topic, perhaps. But we got to keep in mind here that this is a country in which the swing states are in the electoral college map are the ones that count. And it is the economy, and the Democrats do have a strong card to play in the sense that Trump overplayed his hand in the 2016 election. He promised the world, and that really those jobs haven't really materialized in that way. And we still have the split, we still have the great split between the haves and the have-nots. That, to me, is a much more potent message for the Democrats in 2020 than that frankly, impeachment threatens to derail.
Well, let's agree that there are two separate and somewhat related topics on the table now. One, whether a president of the United States violated his oath of office and should or should not be removed from office, number one. And number two, who should be elected president in November of 2020. There's certainly overlap on those two topics, but I think you guys are right to make a point that they're not synonymous. And again, as we talked about earlier, the Democrats succeeded in their House races in 2018 by having the discipline not to become overly captivated by the impeachment conversation. That said, what do politicians of both parties do better than anything else? They overplay their hand. Mm-hmm. Beto O'Rourke, the almost senator from Texas, made a very controversial statement this week. He declared that he was a capitalist. And I'm not maligning either him or those in the Democratic Party who disagree. But I think what will be most interesting to me as the Democratic primary goes forward is whether Democratic primary voters vote with their heads or with their hearts. If Democrats decide, as polls suggest, that beating Trump is the most important goal that there is in 2020, and it's worth making some ideological compromises in order to do so, that's one set of options. If, on the other hand, the lesson from the last 10 years of American politics that Democrats have learned is, hey, we need our own Tea Party, then all of a sudden that middle ground in those swing states that Dan and Carlo were talking about a minute ago become much more up for much more for grabs.
I would suggest a sleeper topic that or a sleeper issue that will be affecting some of those races, or at least increasingly in the minds of particularly the heartland states, is the record numbers of suicides among farmers, which is both obviously an economic and perhaps some other issues. Well, let's talk about a Trump-related issue, but that's a California issue, and that is high-speed rail and Governor Newsom. Dan Borenstein, when California Governor Gavin Newsom announced a either a slowdown or a cancellation of part of the high-speed rail program that had been championed by his predecessor, Jerry Brown, he quickly got into a public spat with President Trump over the remaining funding for that project. What happened and what is likely to happen with this?
Well, I mean, first of all, when I first heard him, his State of the State comments about high-speed rail, there was in me a finally, we're going to have some rational discussion of the reality of this. And we really hadn't even put out the first stories when the backtracking began. And look at the political pressures there are pretty staggering. Within California, the denial of the economics of high speed rail are tremendous. The labor unions want the jobs in the Central Valley. The enviros are in love with high speed rail, no matter whether or not it's actually going to get ridden or not. But as much as it'd be a great thing to have, the economic analyses don't pan out. And more importantly, what voters were originally promised is nothing like what they're actually talking about now. Right. So Gavin had it right at first that we aren't going to be able to deliver this for what's promised. This isn't what the original deal was. And there's really no way to get there right now. But the bottom line is the political pressures within, 12 hours? Was it that long? I'm not sure. The flip-flop was pretty astounding.
But some of the headlines were the governor kills high-speed rail, which really wasn't accurate. He was scaling it back. He was saying, look, his words up there were, let's be real. Right now we can't get it from the Central Valley through the Tehachapis to San Jose. We need to concentrate on the Central Valley. That's where he got into.
But there was nothing in that speech that suggested anything but this is all I'm looking at right now. The fact that he said, but.
Yeah, yeah. The governor's staff called it a communications error. I don't think it was a communications error. I think it was an error of political misjudgment. So first of all, go back. Jerry Brown has known for the last 7.5 years that there would not be high-speed rail in California and kept talking about it because it suited his goals politically. But he knew it was never going to happen. His only goal was not having it killed on his watch. I used to call him Governor Ahab and the Great White Rail because he was obsessed by fighting for this. And I think what happened with Newsom, and I agree with you guys, Gavin Newsom deserves credit. Because, by the way, and Carly, you're right, saying that something is going to happen someday in politics is saying that it's not going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to put a space shuttle on Jupiter. Someday. But there are no political consequences for the next several centuries before I have to worry about actually making that happen. So Newsom, I think Newsom's advisors believed that he would get more points for courage by doing the right thing and pulling the plug on something that wasn't going to happen. He'd get more points for courage than he'd lose for backlash. And when it became clear that it was just the opposite, they backdraft. Well, and saying that it will happen someday is just a polite way in politics of saying, don't hold your breath, your children's breath, or your grandchildren's breath, because it's not going to happen. And I give him credit for that, because I know how to get from L.A. to San Francisco. I call it Southwest.
My problem is
getting from San Francisco to Antioch, and that's why regional transit, of which Dan knows more about this than just about anybody, is really the answer.
When was the last time you were in Antioch?
In a while, but if Newsom is going to redirect a significant amount of high speed rail money toward regional rail in the state's major metro areas, this one included, then I think he deserves bipartisan
approval. But he's not. But that's the thing. He's not going to redirect any money. There's no money in that pot left over.
Well, and Donald Trump wants back $3 billion.
I mean, there's not even enough to do what he wants to do practically. There's just enough barely to do the little segment he wants to do.
So let me ask you this then. If you build a train from Bakersfield to Merced, Are there enough? No, all jokes aside, I mean, the Central Valley does benefit from it. There's economic and cultural, absolutely. But is there enough ridership to pay for it?
No, it doesn't matter. But here's the thing: it doesn't matter because the money has essentially already been committed. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the sad part about it is if you killed that part of it right now, is his thinking, then you wouldn't have any. The money's essentially, so much of it's already been spent. They're going to have. The thinking is, if you complete that one segment, at least then someday,
maybe you can expand.
In the meantime, you can run regular trains over it.
But in the meantime, we've got a war between the Trump administration and California. Yeah. Elaine Chao said, I think today, they're going to try to get this money back.
Right, but that's going to be an interesting technical legal fight because my understanding of it is that the pleading that leg, if they and they've got a deadline, they're there.
Yeah, it's 2024. It's 2022.
Yeah, I mean, they're up, if I remember correctly, they're up against a real tight deadline. But if they do complete that leg, then they have done what they said they were going to do.
And the government can't.
You guys both believe that Gavin Newsom told the truth in his speech and then backtracked from it.
Yes.
Okay.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, back to our program.
Yes, I believe that he said what he intended to say in State of the State speeches. The damn thing about it is they actually write them very carefully. And I really believe that he said exactly what he intended to say. And
Until the blowback.
See, that's a great point. The difference between making a statement like that in answer to a question from an intrepid journalist and maybe saying something you didn't intend to, versus saying it when you are reading draft 45 of a speech that's been written and rewritten and rewritten for several weeks. I think it's
there's no equivocating in the words of the speech itself. I mean, but maybe someday there was none of this, but we're going to look for future money in the future. He just was saying, we're going to complete this little section. This is all we can do right now. We'll do what we can. And there's no money that we can see. I believe his words were something like, there's no way to get from here to there or something like,
It was one of the ways in the State of the State that he kind of differentiated himself from Jerry Brown.
Yes.
I mean, he basically said, I'm not him. Twin tunnels, we're not doing that one either,
He was trying to show. It was right in the same section. They were the first two things in the speech. He was trying to show, hey, it's a new era.
Yeah.
I'm a financial realist.
Right.
I'm giving up on Jerry's
big picture
legacy projects. Right, right. He didn't get them done. I'm not going to invest all this political capital in these. I'm moving on to more important things.
Housing, et cetera.
Right.
Michael Kinsley, the great former columnist, once said that a political gaffe is when a politician accidentally tells the truth.
Yeah. I'm not sure it was accidental, this is the thing, but yes, that's right.
Someone in the audience basically brings up, not only, and we've been talking about Trump and Michael Cohen, we didn't really talk about Trump in Vietnam, meeting with the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, saying, hey, you're not giving him credit for at least trying to denuclearize North Korea. I mean, does he deserve some
credit? I think he gets credit for that. The issue is that this was diplomacy by reality show, kind of, in a way. I mean, there was no preparation. There was certainly not enough preparation. If you talk to people who've have experience in the State Department and elsewhere, he went in there with a lot of pageantry, hoping to... to work this out on a fast track, and this is just not the kind of thing you can do that to. I think the more disturbing thing out of it was, you know, going in praising Kim Jong-un. I'm in love with this guy. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, killed his brother-in-law with poison. Was it the uncle with an artillery gun, and has imprisoned tens of thousands of people in gulags. I mean, and to speak about him like that, like he was a best buddy, I think disturbed a lot of people. Coming out of it, the issue of Otto Warmbier, saying he took the word of the dictator came back in a coma and died days later, an American. And just as he took the word of Putin that there was no intervention in the election, and just as he took the word of the Saudi prince that, well, Jamal Khashoggi, I had nothing to do with that, here we have number three of siding with the dictator.
I think that's right. I'd offer two quick thoughts on this, John. One, Donald Trump is the fourth consecutive U.S. president to overinvest his hopes in the North Korean dictator. And it was more obvious here because it was done in a more demonstrative way, because Donald Trump does everything in a more demonstrative way. But particularly on the Otto Warmbier situation, even those congressional Republicans who wouldn't take him on during the Michael Cohen hearings,
right.
called him out on that. It's a basic matter of...
Even Kevin McCarthy did today.
Of human rights. Right. Trump has gotten some praise from North Korea experts on both sides that this type of approach might be just the type of thing to shake loose some progress, the flattery, the threats, and that sort of thing. But the lack of preparation, and particularly the unfortunate statements about the young man, undermined a great deal of that.
Well, you know, here's that aspect of his unfortunate statements, which are very Trumpian, right? There's a whole series of examples of that. Not obviously, you know, Saudi Arabia, you know, North Korea. You know, there's a whole series of them. But the real interesting question here is how, when you listen to the two different accounts, the North Korean account and Trump's account coming out of today's talks about where they split and where they didn't.
No communication.
How did we get to that point?
Yeah.
You know, are both sides just lying? Is one side lying or not? These things get tough. First of all, this is part of the problem negotiating this in public like this.
That's right.
You know, but
you doing know, the homework ahead of time.
But this is just such a fundamental difference. It's kind of like you want to say, okay, guys, maybe you guys misheard each other. Maybe your interpreter screwed up. Let's get back in the room and maybe you can sort this out. But then you stop and you think, wait a minute, that should have happened before you ever got to North Korea.
Well, and I think whether you call it exaggerations or misleading or lies, this is the real toll that Trump's approach has taken on him. I mentioned that any number of other U.S. presidents have overinvested their hopes in North Korea. I cannot think of another U.S. president who, if arguing a different version of events than North Korean leaders, I don't know that we would be wondering out loud about who was telling the truth and who wasn't. Mm-hmm. We would be logically willing to assume that the North Koreans were misleading for their own purposes. Right. And given the events of the last 2.5 years, in this one, we simply don't know.
Well, no other president that I can think of would have gotten there without essentially a deal done.
Correct.
Right?
That's right.
I mean, it would have been hammered out long before.
Right, the summits for signing and something around.
Yeah, I mean,
that's,
you know, or they would have held
the
private meetings and then had said we're going to meet again or whatever it is. But you don't end up walking away from a room just with a miscommunication, so to speak.
And it is worth noting, you know, as the three people who preoccupied ourselves in the discussion about impeachment a little bit earlier, it is worth noting that as unsettled a time as this is for the country politically, we have in the last 2.5 years not faced a significant major crisis, a world a war, a geopolitical crisis of that nature. You look at India and Pakistan.
That's right.
You look at the ongoing challenges in the Middle East, and the fact that we have not faced a challenge like that since January of 2019, and we're still feeling so unsettled, is really remarkable.
Well, and the reason we're feeling so unsettled is, while it's true we haven't had a huge implosion or a huge event, we've had a very steady erosion of international, I don't know, decorum, of international normalcy. We have this very disconcerting rightward, you know, totalitarian and, you know, bigoted movement that's sort of erupting throughout Europe, which is really disconcerting.
And from a press freedom point of view, I also thought it was disturbing, reporters being thrown out of the session during the meeting with the president and Kim Jong-un. This is the kind of thing that we see in totalitarian countries. We should not see.
And you guys both make a really good point, because we live in the U.S. and because our culture works and our media works the way it does, we tend to hyper-personalize these things. And these broader trends, as Carla and Dan both mentioned, I think, correctly, this is not a uniquely American phenomena. And the ADP in Germany and the Golden Dawn in Greece and the hardcore Brexiters in Great Britain,
Thailand, a
parochialism / nativism / bigotry is not unique to this country. Now, that said, for all of our lifetimes, this country's been held to another in a higher standard. And we're not setting that example anymore. But it would be a mistake, I think you guys are exactly right, to suggest that this is something that is unique to our country and our political leadership. Okay.
And I guess what I'm saying is it would also be a mistake, perhaps, you're right that we haven't, for the last couple of years, had a big erupting event. But I think it would be a mistake to not notice that how much fuel is being put on the fire right now. That was my, yeah.
We'll leave that as the last word. Yeah. We're going to talk to some different kind of fuel, because someone wrote about whether we're going to talk about the radical progressive socialist agenda. So let's talk about the Green New Deal. I don't know if most people really know what's in the Green New Deal. It's worth kind of looking up. But according to a resolution put forward by Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, of course, and Democratic Senator Ed Markey, the bill would transition the country to use 100% renewable, zero-emission energy sources within 10 years. It would also include investing in electric cars, high-speed rail systems. Yep. Sorry, Gavin. It also calls for universal health care, higher minimum wage, and anti-monopoly regulations. Carla, was this a shot across the bow of this newly energized left wing of the Democratic Party, or does it stand any chance of becoming a law?
This is a laundry list, and it's becoming a litmus test for a lot of the presidential candidates. Many of them have now backed it. Of course, you mentioned Nancy Pelosi is like, hang on a second. It's got, you know, this is a 14-page resolution that is just packed with all kinds of stuff. There's a lot of climate change, as you mentioned, high-speed rail transportation. It's also got, you know, indigenous people. It's got cow methane, you know. It's got everything in it. And this is where, when you talk about the Democrats overreaching or, you know, as we go into 2020, the Republicans have already seized on this, as is President Trump, as just being some kind of a socialist agenda.
Well, it is.
Utopian socialist agenda kind of thing. And I think the Democrats have to dial this back. It's all over the place. If you look at, looking at all the different, labor laws, guaranteed job, vacation, health care, trade deals. It's got it all in there. I think the Democrats need to have a focused agenda. A lot of the ideals in here are laudable and something that, you know, and discussions that need to be taken. But whether this is going to become law, I'm going to
Well, first of all, it's a resolution.
It's a resolution.
It's never going to become.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, the costs are, I think some of the estimated costs are $1 trillion when you look at.
51 to 93 trillion, according to an admittedly center-right group. And that's over the decades. So
yeah, over the decades, right. Yeah.
What's interesting about this is the Republicans, even more than they grabbed onto the term Obamacare a decade ago, have really latched onto the phrase socialism.
Yes.
And there's a generational component at work here. If you were not alive or of age of political awareness when the Cold War fell, when the Cold War ended, when the Berlin Wall fell, the word socialism doesn't carry the same emotional impact as it might for previous generations. My students, again, at SC and at Cal both, these are really, really smart people, but you call them a socialist and you may as well call them a Visigoth or a Philistine. It's a historical artifact that does carry some relevance, but not nearly as much. And if you look at public opinion polling, the term is enjoying a renaissance, particularly among younger progressives. But the point that Carla made and the point that Nancy Pelosi is clearly very aware of is the only way not to defeat Donald Trump is to indulge the most aggressive and ambitious ideological goals of the most fervent members of your party and leave the political center open for him to reclaim. I believe as strongly as I believe anything, and I think I've told this group before, I don't think that it is possible for Donald Trump to win re-election, but it is entirely possible for the Democrats to lose.
I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Nancy Pelosi, who initially told Politico that she was dismissive of the new Green Deal, or the Green New Deal, then later she kind of backtracked a little bit and said, oh, I appreciate the enthusiasm of this, quote, and any other proposals, unquote. She kind of has problems on both of her flanks, because this week she was going after, in fact, I think it's today, going after some of the moderate Democrats who have voted with Republicans on certain resolutions. So she's basically telling them, stick in line. She's known for being able to keep her caucus in line.
Right.
But that's happening on, if you will, the right, but the moderate of the Democratic Party. And then on her left flank, you have, you know, the very energized group who just considers her an old person.
Yeah, so, but we keep, you know, what her left flank keeps forgetting is that they didn't win take over Congress from the left flank in November, or the House,
right,
from the left flank. They took it over from the centrist flank. And if they don't stay real with that, they could not only manage to lose the presidency, they could lose the House. And I think that that's,
I think it's been interesting to watch Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez because she's really become the target for the Republicans every day in every way, whether it's whatever she's wearing. She's the new Hillary in that respect. Watching her with the Cohen hearing was really interesting because this was a very smart woman who just didn't use her speeches or bloviate, went right to it, got the information she needed. She has been incredibly skillful in her use of social media and communications. And she's kind of backtracked her original criticism of Pelosi. She's on the cover of Rolling Stone with Pelosi this week. She understands that Pelosi can help her and vice versa. So I think she's definitely someone to watch. And I think you may see her, you know, use her platform to get out all kinds of ideas. But I believe that they will take this and maybe tackle various aspects of it. But you're absolutely right. If they go too far and the presidential candidates, I think that's where to watch. Kamala Harris, for instance.
I mean, every successful presidential campaign, every successful general election presidential campaign has to do two things simultaneously. You have to excite and motivate your base, and you have to be able to reach beyond that base. The Clinton campaign in 2016 and the Romney campaign in 2012 were very effective at reaching beyond their bases, so effective that their bases were not motivated to turn out for them. But just as equal a danger is devoting so much time and energy to motivating your base that you leave people in the center cold. That's what cost Republicans the House in November. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a tremendously valuable tool for the Republican Party to motivate your base, as long as you realize, and this goes to the point that both of you were making, that that's only half of the equation.
Yeah. Okay. So we just got done with an election. What better time to start talking about the next election? The reason I bring this up, of course, is as we were joking about earlier, there are, you know, basically everyone who's a Democrat is running for president. It is the season for announcing their intentions. The most recent I've seen was East Bay Congressman Eric Swalwell, who says he is considering a run. And if he does run, he will give up his House seat. Dan Bornstein, what type of a candidate do you think he would be? Do you think he's serious?
I think he's serious in the sense that I think he wants to run. I think he's a very smart guy. He's politically savvy. And my prediction is that, and folks, if you haven't thought about this, because in 2020 we have an early, we've moved the primary up so that we matter in the presidential primary. But that moves all the other races up too. So we're going to be voting in March in 2020 instead of June, which means the filing to run for offices, local offices, and congressional offices is going to be December. My prediction is that when the time comes in December of this year, that Eric Swalwell will look at how he's doing in the polls. He'll probably be in the single digits. He'll probably be below 5%. And he'll realize that he has a choice, that he can just blow up his entire political career or say, well, I got a message out maybe, you know, and this was a good experience I learned, and maybe next time. And he's going to file the run for it.
I mean, look, he's 38. He's got two little kids. Yeah. He's making all the right moves because he's saying, I don't know if I can run for president because this would hurt my wife's career. I mean, that is such a winner for women. They love to hear stuff like that. He's used the platform very well. He has an opportunity to address millennials. He's been the head and a founder of this thing called the Future Forum for the Democrats, which has taken him around the country to talk to millennials. That's what I think he's aiming for with this. I agree with you, Dan. I think he's going to announce he's going to run for president sometime in April. I think he's going to be on that debate stage. He'll be putting forth those millennial issues, which are really important to the Democrats. He has a base in Iowa because his dad is a police chief in Iowa. He was born in Iowa. He's been there 15 times. He's got staffers there. So it's going to be interesting to watch him and Kamala Harris, they're two Californians. Will they be helped by this early primary, or will she be? It's been pointed out, not necessarily. The last Californian who ran for president and who won the California primary was Jerry Brown in the 70s. He didn't win it the other two times. It's not a lock that Kamala Harris will be advantaged by the early California primary because the votes are split up proportionally. There are many more candidates.
An important difference between Swalwell and Harris.
He's much more centrist than
Not only the other key point, though, in terms of the timing issue, is that for Swalwell, it's not a safe run if he runs for president. For Harris, she doesn't have to risk her seat because she's not up in 2020.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And that's incredibly important. So, you know, I mean, Swalwell in certain ways is exactly the sort of candidate almost the Democrats need. He is a millennial. He's got
a guy from Middle America.
There
is a lane for that in this the contest.
He's got three terms already.
Yeah,
in
three
Congress.
Terms, right?
You know, I mean, he actually has been there, and he's actually been fairly effective for the amount of experience he has.
Right. It's unimaginable to me to see how, in a crowded field of Democratic candidates on a crowded debate stage, that he attracts the attention that he needs to sustain. That said, as Carla pointed out, he's 38 years old, which means if you think about it, he could withdraw from the next 9 presidential campaigns, and he would still be younger than Bernie Sanders when he ran the 10th time. The early The early California primary serves, if anything, to make the first four primaries and caucuses even more important.
Yeah.
Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada get their importance exaggerated even further because you have to win one or more of those in order to come play in California. Carla made a really good point very briefly, and I wanted to underline it, is that because, one, California is such a large state and such an expensive state, and two, because Democrats are where their delegates proportionally, unless Kamala Harris has won two or three or four of those first primaries, what's more likely to happen than anything is you'll see different Democratic candidates targeting different geographic regions of the state.
Exactly.
And California not settling anything, maybe sending a couple of people home. But the proportional awarding of delegates really it serves to prolong a primary, whereas Republicans give their in most states do winner take all, which shortens a primary. And if you think about it, it's a perfect reflection of sort of the philosophy of the two parties. Republicans are winner take all. It's very cut and dried. You win, you lose, you go home, we're done. Democrats say, you didn't lose, you finished second.
Yeah.
We'll give you some delegates and some cookies and everyone will feel better and then we'll go on.
Yeah.
But I do think, given the rules of the Democratic game, it exaggerates the early primaries even more, and California probably gets divided
But here's the thing. Eric Swalwell, and coming back to Swalwell, Eric Swalwell can't even afford, he's got to risk his whole political career to go to the first primary.
Right.
In other words, the timing of it is such that
he could do very well in Iowa.
If he competes in Iowa, he's already passed the deadline to file for his seat.
Oh yes.
He's got to make up his mind before Iowa.
Well, I wouldn't go quite that far. Jerry Brown would tell you that running failed presidential campaigns does not ruin a political career.
Well, that's true. But Jerry wasn't running for president at the same time that his gubernatorial seat was up.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think he's going to give up a very safe seat in East Bay.
I mean, maybe he'll surprise me, but I don't think so.
Yeah. Okay,
Swalwell in 2048.
Yeah.
we're running a bit short on time. I did want to quickly mention we have a new California Republican leader.
That's right.
Yes, they elected a new chairperson, the state party's first ever female chair, 38-year-old Jessica Patterson. Any thoughts?
I was there this last weekend at the California Republican Party convention, and they did take a very big step forward. First ever Latina, she's a mother of two, to be the chairwoman of the Republican Party. I mean, it's a party that's challenged. It's overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly older. So this is a good thing for Republicans. They also, elected the first openly gay man as, treasurer and an Asian-American immigrant as vice chair. This is a good thing for the Republican Party. They need to recapture some of those votes that they've been hemorrhaging for years. She says that the war is on now. The Democrats are on notice that the party's going to change. We're going to have to see if that happens here in California, because that's a very big lift. They're at third party status right now, and the problem is almost any candidate who runs statewide in California with an R after their name, it's a scarlet letter. I mean,
It was a smart thing for the Republican Party to do. It's always better to be a mile outside of hell heading out than 100 miles away heading in. So it was a good, smart step, but it was a small, good first step.
Yeah.
I think the very best that they can hope for, given a state party chair, the best concentrate on infrastructure and logistics and fundraising, they can't really impact the broader political landscape. I think the best thing they can hope for from her is someone who begins taking those tangible steps to lay the groundwork for a post-Trump Republican Party.
That's right, because the challenge is, as long as Trump is
It's worth noting that two of the most popular governors in the country are Republican governors of the deeply Democratic states of Massachusetts and Maryland.
Right.
There's no reason that a Republican can't succeed in this state if they're willing to run a different type of Republican. That won't happen as long as Trump is on the landscape. Once he leaves that landscape, whether it's in 2021 or 2025, someone like Patterson is well positioned to help them take the next steps.
Right.
Okay. Very briefly, because someone in the audience asks about Oakland teachers' strikes. We don't have another week to week for 3 weeks. Will the teachers be striking in 3 weeks, Dan?
Probably not, but, you know, there's a lot of polarization out there. You know, I mean, I'm hearing they keep getting closer, and that's the district keeps upping its offer with every day, you know. I mean, so, you know, but, you know, the thing about this is that there's a much bigger question of what they can afford, and any deal they can afford, you know, they're under state oversight. Will that get any deal get approved? You know, the overseer basically said, "Hey, the teacher's demand of 12%, he won't buy off on."
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean,
Dan, in the LA teachers' strike last month, in addition to salaries and benefits and staffing, in addition to the bottom line dollar issues, the other red letter debate was over charter schools. Has that played into the?
Oh yeah, it's definitely in the discussion there.
It's worth remembering that a quarter of a century ago, charter schools were designed to be a compromise between those who supported private school vouchers on one end and those who were supporters of traditional public schools on the other. And in fact, the original charter school legislation was carried by a Democratic state senator from the Central Coast. It's fascinating to me to watch how what was once the middle ground has become a polar debate.
And it's ironic, one of the most successful charter schools in Oakland was started by Jerry Brown, a military mm-hmm. academy there. He's gotten a lot of funding for it. That this charter school debate is going to continue to go forward. It's interesting to me that the LA teacher strike got so much press.
Yeah.
And really, I feel like the Oakland teacher strike, even though there are tens of thousands of kids out there and parents that are being inconvenienced and teachers that are out on the street, it's not getting the kind of attention, I don't think. And I think that's maybe the mayor is just not. I mean, Eric Garcetti was all over that teacher strike. I'm not seeing that in Oakland as much, so I'm wondering if you're right. In 3 weeks, it could be.
Well, it could
that would be.
Look,
bad for everybody.
Look, I mean,
last words.
There are a lot of issues going on in the Oakland strike, and the basic bottom line is whether there's going to be some fiscal reality of how you help the teachers and at the same time don't drive the district over the financial cliff. And I'm not sure that most people are willing to face question number two,
right.
Part
okay.
number two.
On that note, let's go to our news quiz. Okay, so the first question. Firefighters in the German town of Bensheim have been receiving praise from around the world after they helped who escape from a manhole cover he was stuck in? Ma'am.
A giant rat.
Oh, that rat. That is correct.
Good one.
Wynn Resorts will make a record-setting payout of $20 million to whom? Did anyone see this? The Wynn Resorts, the big gambling firm. Oh, back there? Yes. No. Nope. No, but you're along the right lines. Think about that. I can't see any other hands. The Nevada... Sorry?
You stumped the audience.
Yeah, the Nevada Gaming Commission. It's actually over sexual harassment allegations against the company's former CEO and namesake, Steve Wynn. Okay, don't worry. We have lots of other questions. I have a question that is, now, to deal with California's notorious long lines at the DMV, a state legislator is proposing what be done every other year. Right there.
Registering
your car. That's correct.
Yay.
Okay, the next question. What was former Maine governor and sort of a proto-Trump Paul LePage referring to when he said it would make white people useless? They would no longer matter in this issue. Right there. Right. A legislation that would basically go around the Electoral College and award all their votes based on the popular vote. Interestingly, the former Maine governor now lives in Florida, so that's true. Due to political tensions with Russia, Ukraine has pulled out of what international competition? This is a huge competition that the U.S. is not a part of. Way back there? Eurovision. That's right. The Eurovision Song Contest. Half the people are saying, what is the Eurovision Song Contest? We're not in it. You know? We're not Euro enough. Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she supports exploring whether the United States should pay for what historic crime? Right there in the blue? Slavery reparations, that's correct. Let's head back to Germany. Prosecutors in Germany are considering filing criminal charges against members of an extreme right-wing party that did what in Nuremberg? That kind of has echoes from what used to happen there. Let's put it that way. Anyone see this? No? Okay. They held a torchlit rally at a stage once used by Adolf Hitler. In Germany's defense, I should be pointed out that all of 18 people showed up, as opposed to the hundreds at the Charlottesville rally. Here's a name in the political news. Who is Leslie McRae Dowless? Hint, he's in North Carolina. Right there in the second row?
Yes, he's the guy who did all the phony.
That's correct. He's the political operative who got in, who was doing the ballot shenanigans that are now causing them to do a redo of that election.
And he got charged yesterday.
Yeah. On what day did the U.S. Cyber Command shut down Russia's infamous troll farm, the Internet Research Agency? It was a certain day they shut it down. Yes.
Election Day.
Election Day, the midterm election day. That is correct, because, of course, that's the group that did a lot of interference in our previous election. Now, a man went viral for buying $540 worth of Girl Scout cookies. What happened next to him? That is correct. He was arrested in a DEA drug bust. Sir, put down the Thin Mints and put your hands up. Okay. Sycamore Valley Ranch. That's the new name that was given to a rather famous or infamous ranch in California that was once owned by a now late famous singer. What was that ranch? Ma'am?
Neverland.
Neverland, that's right. Michael Jackson's former Neverland Ranch. By the way, it has been listed a few years ago for $100 million. Now, just days away from that HBO documentary, the ranch is back on the market, listed for only $31
million. Yeah.
And it has a new name. I'm sure that's all coincidence. What former Beverly Hills 90210 star recently suffered a stroke? Right there on the...
Luke Perry,
that is correct. And for our final news quiz question of our 7th anniversary
party. Yay.
Just weeks before a general election there, the prime minister of what country is set to be indicted on corruption charges? Sir, weighing back? Netanyahu of Israel, that is correct. Well, we're going to have more news quiz questions, of course, and a lot more to talk about, including checking in on the Oakland teachers. In 3 weeks on March 20th for our next week-to-week program. Thanks to our great panel today, Dan Bornstein, Carla Marinucci, and Dan Schnurr. Thanks to all of you here and everyone watching and listening online. If you would like to come up and sign our birthday card, we'd love it. But have a great weekend.